In just a moment, we're going to be hearing an interview that I recorded yesterday with Laisha Palin, who is here with the Santa Fe Institute. She's speaking tomorrow night in a talk titled How Social Media Might Help You Survive the Next Big Disaster. It's at 7:30 at the Greer Garson Theater on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. But before that, we are midweek in the KSFR spring, or almost spring, late winter fun drive. And I would like to welcome Jason Silverman, who often comes and helps us during the fun drive. He's the director of the Cinematheque at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
I'm so glad to be here.
I'm so glad. Thank you for getting up so early.
I am up.
Are you? It's really the crack of dawn these days because of daylight savings time.
Yeah, we lost that whole hour.
I know.
Never to be seen again.
I'm feeling it.
You're so good at what you do.
Oh, shush.
I know. You hate when I compliment you.
No, go ahead.
But I have to do it. No, I'm just watching. There's people who, you know, the 10,000 hour rule, right? If people who do things for 10,000 hours get a fluidity and, what they do becomes natural to them.
There's something to that.
And I just see that with you. I just admire people who have gone that far into something where they just do what they do so naturally that they can understand all the rhythms of it. And I'm watching you, and that's how you are.
Well, thank you very much. And the reason he's saying this, ladies and gentlemen, is because we actually want you to call in and support this show. It's time to make those phone calls, and the number is 505-428-1393. Jason Silverman is fanning the pages of his checkbook because he's going to
write a check for Mary Charlotte today.
Thank you for
the Radio Cafe, because people who are good at what they do, Santa Fe needs those people. And, we're a small community, and we're very much talent. You know, we need the talent, and we need to support the talent. We need to support the people who can do things well here, and especially people who are committed to making the community stronger. So I'm a big supporter of Santa Fe Radio Cafe and KSFR. So my checkbook's out.
All right. 428-1393 is the number. And our goal for this hour is $1,500. Now, one of the things that you can get for your gift today and only today is a pair of tickets to basically any movie this entire year at the Center for Contemporary Arts at the CCA Cinematheque, which now has two theaters. Tell people about that.
Well, the Cinematheque, what we call the Cinematheque, the whole program's called the Cinematheque just to confuse things, is our newly renovated theater that you all have been to, and it's got 111 brand new seats, and et cetera. And we also open the studio, which has 47 seats, and we show digital content in there. This year, we fully intend on converting both theaters to the new digital format and being able to show all kinds of great things. We're such a great schedule of films pretty much constantly now. There's so many amazing films being made that it's kind of a buyer's market for film programmers and stuff that matters too. It's not just entertainment. People who really care about the future of the planet are putting all their energies into making these beautiful films.
So it's so true.
It's the golden age of cinema right now, both fiction and nonfiction.
It's a golden age in a lot of ways, even as we're kind of looking at environmental destruction on a level that we've never seen it before. It's a very interesting moment in which to live.
Well, in times of crisis, artists and storytellers step forward, and the stories that they tell have new urgency and new meaning and new poignancy. So we're in that moment now. So writers, filmmakers, artists, they're making beautiful things that actually touch us a little more deeply because we understand what's at stake.
428-1393 is the phone number at the KSFR Fund Drive. There's also an 800 number, or actually a toll-free number, as they call it, because it's not 800. It's 866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. And as I said, we have a $1,500 goal for today, and so we would like you to help us reach that. And we would like to make a special call out to people who have never donated before to public radio, to the Radio Cafe, but who are regular listeners. There's quite a lot of those folks who listen to the program, who come up to me and say, I love your program, I listen all the time, but who haven't actually connected the existence of the program with the support of the community, which is how it works.
Yeah. Can I make a separate challenge?
Yeah.
How about people who whose net value has increased with the increase of the stock market lately? I mean, in after the crash of the market, people were saying, I just can't give. My portfolio has dropped. Well, no excuses now. I mean, there's a lot of people who on paper are worth a lot more money, and Santa Fe's quality of life depends on KSFR. So pull out that checkbook and give a little more than you gave last year.
428-1393 is the number, and $1,500 goal for today. So let's get that first couple of calls to help us meet that goal. And let's go now to Laisha Palin. I'd like now to welcome Laisha Palin. She is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she's the director of Project EPIC. EPIC stands for Empowering the Public with Information in Crisis. She's part of the human-centered computing area at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she will be giving a talk titled How Social Media Might Help You Survive the Next Big Disaster, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are involved in a new kind of interdisciplinary research, and I think your work is so interesting because it's a lot of stuff that's never been done before, and the methods are new. You're evolving them as you go along. It's called crisis informatics. What's that all about?
So crisis informatics was born out of an observation I made in 2005, coming from an existing field of research that I had been working in for a long time called computer-mediated communication and computer-supported cooperative work, that it would seem that with the pervasive technology that we had available to us at the time, and then recall that in the U.S. we weren't using texting even very much. It was adopted a bit more broadly overseas, but not very much in the U.S., but it seemed that the sign of the times with the deployment of mobile phones to virtually everyone and the improvements in network technology that we were going to see some interesting things happen as soon as there was something interesting that happened out in the world. And so when we look at disasters, we are looking at social convergence of people and of resources and of ideas. And when you look at the massive distribution of technology, it seemed like these were two things that would match up in terms of people innovating during events where they were needing to coordinate with each other, needing to solve problems, and this kind of thing. And so the work was born out of those early ideas, and unfortunately, very tragically, Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and then Rita, its immediate follow-on, very quickly demonstrated that those ideas were going to be something we needed to be able to lean on very heavily. And so since that time, my group has grown. I've grown in collaboration with others. We've graduated students who have specialized in this area of looking at social computing methods, that is the examination of big data, looking at it both quantitatively and then diving in very critically and looking at it almost ethnographically to understand not just who is speaking to whom online, but what they're doing and why are they doing it, and what does the nature of that work in the case of work when it becomes something that people accomplish, products that they create in response to problems that they see in disaster, what does that look like?
Products they create?
Right. So we became very interested in the public participation aspect of technology in disaster response. And so before all of this, there had been a fair amount of research done on new ICT, new IT for emergency management as a formal response.
ICT, information
communication technology. But looking at largely closed systems that would help emergency managers, first responders, and aid workers do their jobs better, which is great. We need to keep having that. But the rise of mobile technology and then social media not long after that put new attention or renewed attention on the role of the members of the public in disaster response.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about this is that as you write in some of your work, a lot of your first responders are actually the disaster victims
themselves. Yes. That's right. That's right. And this is based on observations of, the 100 years or so of research we've had on the sociology of disaster, where that research has really called to attention the role of members of the public, because without them, we wouldn't have the kind of immediate response that we have. And so they are the ones who rescue people from the rubble because they know the layout of the land. They are in the city, in the area that is affected, say, for example, by an earthquake, whereas it takes some time for groups to come in and perform rescue.
They know who the most vulnerable neighbors
exactly,
are.
Exactly, exactly. They bring people to hospitals because in a disaster is a disaster when the resources of a city or a region or larger are compromised, and there aren't enough emergency medical services, for example, to go around. And so you have people transporting each other to hospitals. I mean, this becomes the definition of a disaster. And without that help, we wouldn't actually have the kind of response that we do have. We depend on members of the public for very critical functions. So it goes beyond the sort of the very nice things that people might do later on, which is to have food lines and raise money and all those things, also very important. But their work goes to the very critical aspects of emergency response. And sometimes we don't quite appreciate when we think about emergency management policy, we forget in our planning stages how critical it is to not think of the members of the public as people to just police. They are active participants and critical participants in the work of emergency response.
And so when you have suddenly cell phones, internet, and all kinds of communications, what kinds of response systems emerge in the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 hours of a disaster, whether it be, well, 9/11, that was, as you say, sort of before texting and all of that, but in, say, Hurricane Katrina or in Hurricane Sandy in New York recently.
So I think there's some commonalities. I think the behaviors are changing and growing as people become more experienced and more fluent with social media. But you also see some differences depending on the kind of event that people are encountering. So, for example, earthquake detection. Some of the very immediate things you see on Twitter and online during an earthquake is that people are sensing an earthquake, and their posts actually follow very closely exactly what those the feelings of intensity are. For events that are protracted, for which we might have warning, you see different kinds of behaviors emerge before the event. People trying to figure out what to do, trying to understand the true risk that might affect them, what they would do if they decide that the risk is going to reach a certain threshold. Increasingly, we're seeing we've seen this for a while, but we're seeing even more of it. We're seeing some behaviors that I think are creative and surprising. We see people who are finding bits of information from one part of the net or one part of the Twitterverse, if I can call it that, and they're finding information elsewhere and then putting it together and adding something new to the information space. So, like, for example, one of the things that we've written about in the Twitter activities in the midst of the 2009 Red River floods that affected North Dakota and up into Canada, the USGS made a data table available that showed flood levels at different points along the river. And somebody created a little tweet bot and botted out those different levels. And yet another person who was a pilot, seemed to be a private pilot, located elsewhere, I think he was in Florida, well outside the area, has some experience reading topographical maps. And so he said, well, you know, I'm looking at the topography of the region. I see this USGS data, flood data information. He said, I kind of predict this might be where the most dangerous spots might be along this river. And this was just all done kind of as an improvised way of adding value to the space, probably based on a recognition that this exists. This data exists. I have this resource. Here's what I can offer.
And it's such a striking example of what happens when you don't just rely on the authorities, but you have, I don't know what it's called, crowdsourcing or the kind of wiki everybody participates, you get something probably more powerful and certainly in moments like that more effective than if you were relying on specialists.
I think what we see and what I hope to see in the future is a convergence of The kind of information we get by crowdsourcing or crowd work, either opportunistically or by design, and that information that we get from authorities and agencies, there really is an opportunity for these things to come together. When we write about past events, in 2007, 8, 9, 10 even, we don't see a lot of agencies online tweeting and posting. Since 2010, I think we've seen some changes there, and so now the questions are a little bit different about how you synthesize those pieces of information together. But the stories we told, the illustrations that we called out in the late 2000s were about, they were done in absence of there being much authoritative information online, right? And so you see this, so to say, I hesitate to say it's more valuable than what authorities put out. It was just moving ahead of what they were able to do at the time. And so we use those as opportunities to say, this is the kind of information genesis, the kind of information synthesis that can happen when you look at it at large among a community of people. I think now the questions are changing. We can think about, now we know, for example, when agencies do have a Twitter presence online, they are among the most retweeted accounts. People seek that information out as well, and they move it around. So there really is a necessary place in this information ecology, if we can call it that, for authoritative information, no matter where it comes from.
We're talking to computer scientist Laysha Palin about the role of social media in disaster response. And you're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we're live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. And I think we've got a report from the control room, and I think we've got some thank yous.
We do indeed. Actually, from the news hour, they were taking a poll about labeling, because our city council is going to be discussing that issue and perhaps voting on it tonight.
Right.
And Mary McIntyre, who's a chiropractor in Los Alamos, is for labeling on food as far as GMOs go.
Excellent.
And then we have also Mud Flood of Taos, an outdoor gear shop, to thank. And David Barsamian, who is here for tonight's Lannan program,
Yay.
Called in, and he said he really appreciates two brilliant voices.
Well, thank you so much. He's a wonderful, wonderful radio host. He's the longtime host of Alternative Radio, which airs on KSFR and which is syndicated on many stations all around the country and which has a fabulous website. And David Barsamian is one of the real leaders of public radio and alternative radio. He's fabulous. Thank you so much, David. So, all right, let's get the telephones ringing, 505-428-1393, 428-1393, and that is the number to call to keep public radio on the air. It's as simple as that. We don't have commercials, we're not selling cars, we're not selling soap and cereal. All we've got is what we've got, which is this programming, and if you want to support it, if you want it to be on the air, you got to support it, and that's what you do. You call. And when you call in, you get fabulous prizes, like a pair of tickets to the CCA. Now, what's happening, Jason Silverman, tonight at the CCA?
We have a special event. We have a lot of special events lately. This one's especially special because it's with the Santa Fe Institute.
So we're double Santa Fe Institute. They've got an event tonight and another event tomorrow night.
You need a program just to keep track of what's going on with Santa Fe Institute.
It's
they have so
true.
Much stuff happening.
Yeah.
So tonight it's Paula Sabloff presenting Never Cry Wolf. We have a series that we started in conjunction with the Institute called Science on Screen. And we bring some of the geniuses from up on the hill down into town, and they show movies and they talk about them and they introduce them and they connect it with the research that they're doing. So we had Murray Gell-Mann do Groundhog Day, which was
and The Gods Must Be Crazy.
And The Gods Must Be Crazy. And Chris Wood did Memento. And Chris Moore did Primer last month. And so tonight's Paula and Never Cry Wolf, which is a phenomenal film. Carol Ballard is one of those filmmakers who will probably someday be a subject of a film himself. He's made these beautiful films, Black Beauty and Never Cry Wolf and Duma. And he is, he doesn't get any work anymore. His films are incredible. They actually make money. but there's something. His films are oddball enough and a little bit off the beaten path enough that he doesn't get the calls. So he's living as a farmer in Northern California now.
Oh my goodness!
And I really think he's one of the masters of U.S. cinema, and he makes these films that are deep and rich, and they're set in natural places, and they explore the connection between human and animal, and this is one of those. It's a story of it's an autobiographical story by the Canadian environmentalist and writer Farley Mowat, who as a young man was dropped into the wilds of the Arctic to study the wolf and caribou population, and so this film takes us up there and revisits it.
So Paula Sabloff from the Santa Fe Institute will be introducing this film. She chose the film. It's at the CCA, and if you call in right now to KSFR, you can get a pair of tickets to any film at the CCA in this calendar year, including the film tonight. The number is 428-1393. And a special call out not only to first-time listeners, but to scientists and people in science families and people involved with the Santa Fe Institute, with the lab, and with any of the other science institutions in this state. Please give us a call, because we do quite a lot of science on this show, and there's not a whole lot of science coverage in the media these days. 428-1393. It's very important that the phones be ringing and that we reach our $1,500 goal by today, by the end of this hour. And hey, we just got a $500 challenge from the ALH Foundation, and it's starting now. So any dollar that you give, up to $500, will be matched. So in other words, if 10 people call with a $50 contribution each, we will have not just $500, but $1,000 by the end of this hour. 428-1393.
Talking about science and the arts, you know, if you wanted to have a snapshot of what Santa Fe was all about, you would just have to listen to KSFR for a week or so, and particularly the Radio Cafe, because the arts coverage, the coverage of social issues, the coverage of science, you figure out what's going on here and what Santa Fe is all about. You know, you hear some of the strong voices and understand the programming and what issues are, you know, so it pulls us out of isolation in a sense, too, because you can hop into your car, drive to work, head to your cubicle, get back in your car and head home and not even know what's around you. But if you listen to KSFR, you do.
428-1393, and we're less than 20% of the way to our $1,500 goal for this hour. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's make those telephone calls. And we're going to go back now to Laysha Palin and the interview that I recorded yesterday up at the Santa Fe Institute. And please give a call right now, 428-1393. Please make a contribution to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe and to this show, just so that we can stay on the air for another several months, which is what it's all about. All right, we'll be back. So we're talking about how social media work in a disaster, and you've got authoritative information, you've got information that is put out by people who are in an area who know more because they're already on the ground mm-hmm. when this disaster hits, whether it be an earthquake or a storm or whatever. And there is the question of whether people trust the authorities. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when there is a mandatory evacuation, there's always people who don't evacuate. How do you think about that? How do you deal with it? How do the technologies that you're working with help you to understand and work with all of that?
Okay, that's a great question. So I think the first thing to know or to understand is that it's always been this way. There's always some who resist evacuation, either because, you know, they don't want to leave their homes, they feel that they can defend their homes. Maybe they have other reasons. Maybe they have an elderly person in their home and they can't easily evacuate, or they will evacuate, but they first have to decide, gosh, I can't go in the direction that I'm supposed to go because my kids are over in school on this other part of town. And so I don't know if it's when we look at the research over the decades of disaster that preceded this sort of social media age, we would see these behaviors. And I don't always know if it's resistance to authority, but it's more about people having to localize their decisions based on what they see, what they know, and what their particular circumstances are. So they might completely respect the direction about what to do, but they might have some other immediate obstacles they have to solve before they can execute on that. And so when we look at past research, I think of the work of Sorensen and Sorensen, they show that people will always assemble a web of information. In this case, they weren't referring to the World Wide Web, but that's kind of a nice sort of connection to what we see today. People have always assembled a web of information that they glean from their family and friends. They glean it from everywhere, and they put this together and then decide how they're going to act. So what we see today is yet more places in which they could seek that information and assemble their sort of own local awareness and interpretation of what's going on. They have to match that outside view against the immediate things that they're facing.
I would think that one of the things that happens when you're faced with a disaster and everybody is suddenly tweeting and texting and doing their social media stuff with one another is that there would be the danger of a proliferation of misinformation and rumor, and that's part of what you have to deal with probably in much greater amount than you did before all these media.
This is another important topic, the matter of the veracity of information, the trustworthiness of the source. It's something we do have to worry about in the way that we worry about where all information comes from. What we see during kind of, I would say, the time closest to the event and by community members who are directly affected by the event is we see a very strong drive towards the system of people and the information that they're working with striving towards veracity. So it tends to be less about the judgment of one particular piece of information and more about the processes by which people decide something is valuable. So there's a great deal of self-policing online. We have evidence of different events.
What
where
do you mean, self-policing?
Self-policing. So people will check other people's claims about what they're saying. One might say that they could attribute a trustworthy behavior. A trustworthy behavior is one where somebody realizes, yes, I wasn't correct about that. Here's the corrected information. So people are policing each other. They're also policing themselves if they're a good source of information. If they're not a good source of information and they continually show that they're not correct, then they become ostracized because they're not demonstrating goodwill about striving to get the information correct. The thing about disaster response, really a mass emergency response, is that sometimes it's hard to know exactly what is the correct information. It's always imperfect. There isn't this sort of eye in the sky that tells us this is exactly right or wrong. So there can be information that turns out not to be exactly right, but it was as right as we knew at that particular point in time. The bigger issue, I think, around misinformation and the propagation of information that might not be appropriate might be that, for example, it's true for you in your neighborhood, but it's not true for me in my neighborhood. So that targeting of the audience, the mismatch between the speaker and the audience, might be more of the concern rather than it's easier to find the deliberate pieces of misinformation. It's harder to detect, to know who the information is best for, because, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if you have somebody on a hill and somebody in a valley in an earthquake zone, their needs and their experience are going to be really different.
Both are truthful. But, you know, the information they might have access to is truthful, but it might not be appropriate for each of them, right? So that, I think, is the harder challenge when we talk about misinformation rather than the outright, you know, signal that we're looking for. Is it good? Is it bad? The other issue would be information that's good at time zero may no longer be good at time two, time one or two.
And time one or two might be 15 minutes.
Exactly, right. So those I think are the harder problems that we're wrestling with how to manage the information environment that we've got emerging in front of us.
So you have, I mean, there have been people responding to and studying, sociologists and journalists and everybody else, studying disasters for a really long time, and mm-hmm. disasters are part of the history of literature and drama and all of that, and that's all part of what you study. So then the next phase for you guys is, okay, what do we do about it? How right. do we help to create information systems for ordinary people mm-hmm. to tap into, so that if they are, for example, in an earthquake zone or a flood zone, that their chances of survival are better?
So there's a lot of things happening in both the research and the community of practice of both professional emergency management as well as sort of what I'll call citizen responders, those who are not officially employed as emergency managers, but maybe were in the past or have a lot of experience in emergency management as volunteers. So what we're seeing, and there's a great deal of activity in this area. One of the ways to think about all this, you know, what we do with all this citizen reporting is, can we opportunistically use it to create, to help us flesh out our understanding of the situation, help us develop a better situational awareness of what's going on. How could, and this could be helpful to anybody, right? Any, you know, the authorities, people who are trying to make decisions, the idea is that it can be done in complement with all stakeholders in emergency response.
And I mean, you would think that would be kind of a no-brainer, because everybody, and we find this in the city of Santa Fe, neighborhood associations know their neighborhood so much better then the city council knows their neighborhood, and so they are really able to help make good decisions for their neighborhood. In a disaster, I would think that would be amplified.
Right. And so there are, but you know, when we're looking at, say, Hurricane Sandy, for which we've collected roughly 20 million tweets that appear to be about the hurricane, this is a lot of data coming down the pipe live, right?
Right.
And so what the research and development right now is trying to do is trying to automatically parse and derive the critical pieces of information based sometimes on very sort of plain spoken English, actually as it's modified in a tweet, which can be really compressed down when it's down to 140 characters. So there's a lot of work in natural language processing and machine learning to see if we can derive that information, associate it with the location, associate with the other kinds of features of metadata that tell us this is good information, it's coming from this source, we need to listen to it, or even there's an absence of information over here, what does that mean? Are people in a good situation, or are they in really a terrible situation? Then there's all these new skills and behaviors that are emerging as people get more practice at doing this. And one of the things I'll be talking about both at the Santa Fe Institute as well as tonight at the lecture is the rise of the digital, what's called the digital volunteer. These are people who have moved from disaster to disaster. They work completely virtually or nearly completely virtually, and they look for good information and then try to amplify it and consolidate it to be able to deliver it to you, to make it useful to you. So there's this human computation, there's this machine computation that might help us with information visualizations and maps. There are a community of people called crisis mappers who try to mark all this up on maps that are immediately consumable for people who are experiencing the disaster or who might want to help those who are experiencing disaster. We saw this to a great extent in response to Haiti, for example.
Right, right. We're talking to computer scientist Laisha Palin about how social media might help us survive the next big disaster. And you're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and there was a mistake, and that was actually my mistake. Her lecture is tomorrow night, not tonight. It's at 7:30 at the Greer Garson Theater. Laisha Palin talking about all of these, I think, very interesting issues about social media and disasters. Now, ladies and gentlemen, social media or media will, like KSFR, will be a big disaster if you don't donate. The phones have been a little quiet, and we are nowhere near our $1,500 goal for this morning. And I'm going to start to either take it personally or be sad if people don't start calling seriously, because, I mean, I love doing this show. People seem to love listening to it. And if you don't support it, then how are we going to stay on the air?
Well, it's more important than that. You know, I love hearing you talk, but there's a battle for our for our, you know, our hearts and minds now, and what KSFR does and what independent media does is essential. I mean, we cannot survive without it. The mainstream media is funded by people who want to sell you things, and they have an agenda. And when you watch TV, even when you watch a mainstream film, you are being sold something. And that something is not necessarily good for you. The people who make that have a profit motive in mind. The people who tell you stories through KSFR, through alternative radio, through all independent media, but particularly through public radio, which is publicly funded, which is funded by the community, are here to do it because they think it's important, because they're committed to it. They're doing it out of love, out of passion, and out of concern for our community and our future. There's not anything like it, and it's necessary. We need to counter the other kinds of messages that we're getting.
428-1393 is the number, and I know sometimes people say, hey, you have to give the phone number more often. 428-1393. And let us see. There has been some ringing activity. We'd love to hear that. And we are not quite at $500 in our $1,500 goal. So, yeah, there is a match from the ALH Foundation, which is a beautiful thing, for $500. So if we can get $500 by the end of this, another $500 by the end of this hour, we will have just about reached our $1,500 goal. So let's go for it. 505-428-1393. 505-428-1393. And let me give you an example of the kind of thing that Jason was talking about just now. I get in my inbox for the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, in my email, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails. And a lot of them are from publicists who somehow get the emails of every radio producer in the United States of America, and they send you stuff. Here's one that I've been getting. It's from a group called the Independent Women's Forum. Well, that sounds good. What are they doing? They are giving a panel called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Plastic Water Bottles, Fracking, Genetically Modified Food, and Big Gulp Sodas. And what they're talking about is they're against the culture of alarmism. That's what the Independent Women's Forum is about. So basically what they're saying is sit back and enjoy being screwed over by the corporate system that is feeding you all this stuff that's bad for you, and learn to love it.
We're in this media world, in this information zone, where it's hard to tell what's up and what's down anymore, because there's so much competition with real information, with fact-based information, with science, from people who are feeding us disinformation, that we get confused. And so you need to know where you can turn for good information.
That's right.
And you have to look at where that information is coming from. The fact that there's any kind of debate in the media about global climate change is completely alarming, because it's the most researched,
98% consensus among scientists, who tend not to have 98% consensus on anything.
And, you know, and it's the biggest research project taken at all in human history. So you have to be careful about what you consume as citizen in this media age. You have to be very careful about where your information is coming from. And that's true when you're listening to independent media as well. But what's different about KSFR is that nobody's here to sell you anything. They're here to give you information, to share information about the community, to play great music for you. And it's something that you can count on in a media zone that is very uncertain and confusing. So
428-1393.
Yeah,
support, I'm just saying.
Support KSFR. It's a great way. I just wrote my check, and I feel so good about it. I feel like writing another one right now.
Yay. You're so kind and so generous. And please be generous. 428-1393. I can't believe this thing about loving plastic water bottles, fracking genetically. I mean, what else do they love? Thalidomide, DDT, nuclear waste. Shall we have a nuclear waste with thalidomide sundae? I mean, it's... But, and here they are. They're putting their stuff out into the world. They're probably very well funded. And we exist not to fight them, but just to get information out there that's based on research, based on investigation, based on science, that is not funded by people who are purely out to make a profit at all costs, no matter what the cost to society.
And what's your agenda in doing that? Because I know that you don't. I know that you don't get paid much, and I know that how hard you work, and I know what you put into this. What's your agenda in doing that?
Truth telling. That's it?
Yeah.
428-1393. We're going to go back to Laisha Palin, just another couple of minutes on that interview. Please make the calls right now to 428-1393 so we can reach our $1,500 goal for this hour. Thank you so much. Now, you said earlier that a disaster is, I mean, I heard you to say a disaster is not defined just by, for example, the fact of a storm or earthquake or natural disaster or a fire, but the inadequacy of the response to that disaster. So it's as much a human phenomenon as it is a natural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so earthquakes, storms, weather-related events, volcanoes, these are all hazards, natural hazards. And so a hazard, when it interacts with a built environment, could become a disaster. Might not always, right? So an earthquake that affects San Francisco with good building codes, that magnitude of an earthquake at a certain depth might hopefully will cause less destruction than in an area where they don't have those building codes.
Like those earthquake-proof buildings.
Exactly.
That they build. Yeah.
Right. So a hazard. You have a hazard, and then it's an impact on the built environment determines to what degree we have. What kind of emergency on our hands. And so when things become, disastrous and catastrophic, it's usually, I mean, there's the personal effects of something being disastrous, and I would never take away a personal loss as being personally disastrous if you think about that in its psychological terms, but we think about it in its social terms, in terms of how our society is able to respond to it, how resilient a society is to it. That determines whether we're able to. That's based on capacities, whether we have the resources and the capacities to be able to respond to that particular event. And of course, some areas can be very well prepared, and disasters can be just so enormous that we don't have those capacities to get enough people to enough hospitals and those kinds of things.
Well, and I mean, if an earthquake and a fire happen together and houses burn, you can have all the capacity you want and you've got a bunch of burned down houses.
That's right.
Now, are people more altruistic? Do the best qualities of people come out during disasters?
It seems so when we, you know, pre-ICT, pre-information and communication technology, when sociologists would look at behaviors of communities in the wake of a disaster event, they describe those communities as altruistic, and this is meant to especially be in response to this very easy inaccurate claim that people are panicking, that they're looting and doing, suddenly becoming acquiring all these terrible characteristics that they might not have had before. Communities immediately in the wake of the disaster tend to be very altruistic. People tend to help each other a lot. It's in their best interests to do this. When we try to think about that as it appears online, we have to be careful. I think when we look at some of the events that happened in 2006, 2007, where, say, the big wide world wasn't always involved online, didn't have a hand online in every disaster, we could say that we saw altruistic response. I think as we go on and on in time, I think we still have a system of people that's trying to drive information as resource towards truth, towards veracity, towards helpfulness. But you have to be careful because not everyone who responds is part of that geographical community anymore. They might have a different investment in that event. as time goes beyond that immediate hour, 2 hours, week, 2 weeks, you might then have to think about who the other actors might be who are involved. I think my hypothesis is that closer to the event, closer in the space-time of an event, you have greater altruism.
That's certainly what I heard from people during the Hurricane Sandy in New York. Somebody said for several days, everybody was really great to one another, and then they just turned back into New Yorkers again, in the negative sense of that word. And the people uptown who weren't affected didn't really have any use for the people downtown whose lights were out.
Yeah. But it's a behavior we do. We do see this kind of volunteer helpful behavior in response to events around the world. So even where there might be cultural differences in how people are oriented towards their neighbor, towards the other, towards volunteerism, it seems to suspend, whatever that might be, it seems to suspend itself in these immediate days following certain kinds of disaster events.
We're talking to computer scientist Laysha Palin. And this is KSFR Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and Laysha Palin will be speaking tomorrow night, Thursday the 14th of March at 7:30, at the Greer Garson Theater, which is on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. That's a new location. I think it was somewhere else before, but it's at the Greer Garson tomorrow night, and definitely worth checking out. And tonight, as we mentioned before, at the CCA, Paula Sabloff, who is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, will be introducing the film Never Cry Wolf, and that's at 7 o'clock tonight. The event tomorrow night is free. The event tonight will be free for you if you make a donation right now to KSFR and get a pair of tickets. You can use them tonight or you can use them for any event in this calendar year at the CCA Cinematheque. You can go to a movie with a friend or family member, 428-1393. 428-1393. Now, I think we have some thank yous. I think the phones have been ringing.
Oh, we've got lots of thank yous, and I'm not sure if I have all of them, and I don't have the totals yet because they've been so busy.
Oh, good.
That I know Karen is in there right now adding up things. And I think the phones are free right now, so people could still call 428-1393.
Excellent.
Here are some thank yous. George and Elise Packard.
Yay.
Jan, who loves your show.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if I've got this all right. Voice Jansen? I'm not quite sure. Anyway, loves.
Oh,
loves
yeah, it's show. Probably Jan Willem Janssens.
Oh, that might be it, yeah. And then
thank
Catherine
you.
Drawn and Charlotte Reeder.
Yay.
Peter Green.
All right.
Sally Bingham.
Yay.
Frank Regano.
Yes.
Denise Cope.
Yes.
Janet, and this is either Eigner.
Eigner, yeah.
Eigner. Okay, great.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I'm
thank
sure
you,
there's
thank
others,
you, thank you, thank
and anonymous, too.
Okay, and so we are still looking for our $1,500 goal. I have a feeling we're getting there, but we're not there yet. We've got 5 minutes left until 9 o'clock, and we will know after the 9 o'clock news whether we've reached our goal, and it means a lot to me that you guys can help us. So the number is 428-1393. Please give a call right now.
Santa Fe is so great when you know who's donating to your show. You know, you hear the names and you know these people. They're your neighbors, their community. And I think what we're up against here is you know, we've got a grassroots battle here to get good information out to the world. And I do it at the CCA. You do it with KSFR. There's people around this community that are doing it. And they're trying to get important stories in front of us. They're trying to get inspiring art in front of us.
Yep.
Ideas that provoke us. We're up against it, though, because the people who are trying to tell the other kinds of stories have a lot more resource than we do.
They have a lot more resources than we do, and I hate to make it an us-against-them thing, because I still have this kind of ideal that if we can all come together and actually listen to each other, that we can make some headway against the divisiveness that this country is. But we do have this phenomenon of people who are telling you that plastic water bottles are good, and they're really not good. And there are people like the Koch brothers who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on what are essentially amount to disinformation campaigns.
Exactly. And the way that we progress is by working together as a community, by chipping in and by supporting each other. And certainly this is a moment where we need independent radio. We need independent voices. We need KSFR. We need Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And they don't exist unless we all chip in. And, you know, if you watch the mainstream media, you are paying. You know, you are paying by giving your time to advertisers.
Well, you're also paying because if you're watching it, there's a very good chance that you're subscribing to satellite or cable television, which costs you a certain amount per month. And if you can give even a fraction of that amount per month to KSFR, and just think of it as your cable bill, you can sign up as a sustaining monthly donor and give, let's say, $15 a month, which is a tiny fraction of your cable bill. It's less than Netflix,
yeah,
depending on what kind of Netflix you get. But basically, it's like that. And you get 24 hours a day of programming. You get Democracy Now!, you get the Radio Cafe, you get Jazz, you get Bill Dupuis' News Department for a minor, minor expenditure.
We don't need to just keep these things alive and breathing. And I kind of, you know, that way of speaking about it alarms me, because what we need is KSFR to be growing and getting stronger and finding more listeners and finding more ways to get out into the community. We need, you know, the Lensic and the Opera and Site Santa Fe and the 150 nonprofits that are in town. We need all of them to be stronger and stronger if we're going to move together to a better future, because we have a lot of challenges facing us. And so it's time now to invest in our community. And a really easy way to do that is to call KSFR now.
428-1393, and I'm going to stay on until after the news and just see what our totals are and see if we've reached our $1,500 goal. But I want to thank everybody who has contributed so far, and I want to thank everybody who's about to contribute in the next 5 minutes. So do I hear a little typings or noisings from the control room? Ah, maybe not. I thought I did. Anyway.
Well, I'm here. I was just typing on the computer. I was going to chat with you. But are you there, Mary?
Yes.
Okay, it's so quiet. Let's see. We have Robin Johnson to thank.
Thank you.
And he really loves your show.
Thank you.
David Aubrey, who definitely loves your show as well. Madeline Pryor.
Thank you.
And Anonymous. And I haven't quite done the math here, but we're well over 1,000, so we're getting close.
Wonderful. Excellent, excellent. $1,500 goal, and some of that will be matched by the ALH Foundation. So, 428-1393, just about a minute, half a minute left till we go out. I want to thank Jason Silverman. Jason Silverman is one of the lights of our community. He's the director of the CCA Cinematheque. The CCA is on Old Pecos Trail. It's right near the Children's Museum and the Armory for the Arts. It's just a wonderful place. Probably many of our listeners have been there countless times. Probably some of our listeners have never been there before. So definitely check it out. And tonight, once again, at the CCA, Never Cry Wolf. Jason, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. It's time for the news, and we'll be back after the news. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks. It's an honor.